It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
This will only resonate if you've lived in New York City or understand the New York culture, but a couple decades ago, a lot of these $1 a slice pizza shops sprung up around the city. There was still plenty of much more expensive gourmet, all the toppings kind of pizza places. But this was aimed at, you know, working class folks who just wanted to get a good, low cost slice. But now, and it's on the cover of the New York Post, the last remaining dollar store has had to hike the price to $1.50. End of an era. It's still pretty cheap, but it's not a buck. So I don't know if Joe Biden, feeling that the White House events have gotten kind of boring, is trying to spice them up. But 2 days ago, the cast of Ted Lasso was there. Yesterday, all kinds of stars were there, including Bruce Springsteen. And the president said, the boss is here, as they say in South Philly and North Wilmington, a Jersey boy. He goes on to say that Springsteen is the recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, along with 20 Grammys, an Oscar, a Tony, and an unyielding love from millions of fans across generations. So this was, he was giving out a bunch of art awards in the arts. So there's also Gladys Knight of the Pips, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and a whole other list of luminaries. And, you know, I mean, every White House has these events, but it does seem like that they are just trying to make some news or be a little more colorful. So, Tucker Carlson was on radio show in New York, Bo Snerdly's Rush Hour. Bo was Rush Limbaugh's longtime sidekick. And he was asked about, you know, Trump and the text, and he said, I spent 4 years defending his policies, and I'm going to defend them again tonight. Actually, I'm pretty straightforward. I love Trump like a person. I think Trump is funny and insightful. And I said this to Trump when he called me, you know, all wounded about those texts. That would be the text in which he said, I hate him passionately and called him a demonic force and so forth. There was a moment in time when I was absolutely infuriated. And those were all grabbed completely illegitimately, in my opinion, in the court case, which I guess I'm not allowed to talk about. He claimed he was just angry with the former president because he felt humiliated by one of Trump's campaign staffers who fed him the names of, quote, dead voters who had voted, which he repeated on the air, some of whom turned out to be alive. Well, last night on his show, Tucker said, you've got to hope for the sake of the country, the Biden White House, which will be running against Trump, will put this country above partisanship and stop this. And that Merrick Garland at DOJ will issue a very public statement saying this is wrong, which it is, and therefore preserve for our grandchildren our justice system. But I don't see where Biden or Garland has any authority whatsoever, any influence whatsoever, over the Manhattan District Attorney, who's an elected state official. Okay, so President Biden has vetoed his first bill. Well, he didn't have to veto anything in the first 2 years because the Dems ran both chambers. Blocking the repeal of a Labor Department rule that permitted retirement investing tied to environmental and social goals. So if you cared about the environment and social justice, your money could be invested only in companies that, or organizations that upheld those values. The veto was expected. This was pushed by the Republicans. Some of the more moderate Democrats, like Joe Manchin, were supportive of it. And Biden said, you know, Biden, who hasn't attacked anybody lately, this bill would risk your retirement savings by making it illegal to consider risk factors MAGA House Republicans don't like. Your plan manager should be able to protect your hard-earned savings, whether Rep. Marjorie Taylor Greene likes it or not. Okay, so I'm in the same bind as I was yesterday. Remember, yesterday, Tuesday, was the day that Donald Trump was going to be arrested, according to Donald Trump. Well, that didn't happen, obviously. Today, as I'm sitting here, it might happen. I'll try to do an update later if it does. The grand jury in Manhattan is meeting today, so that would make sense, unless the grand jury is continuing to hear other witnesses. I was on a special report last night, and I said this. The Republicans are rallying around Donald Trump over his pending indictment, which just shows you, you know, Trump's sort of media mastery, because he puts out this statement last week, you know, witch hunt and go protest and I'm going to be arrested on this certain day. And he completely dominates the news. I mean, it's unbelievable how much he is dominating the news right now. And so what I said was, look, the Republicans are rallying behind Donald Trump. And then they say, oh, it's not really. We're just for equal justice. Well, they could say, you know, inappropriate to comment, but they're not. They're embracing him. And that's fine. It's smart politics on Trump's part. But what I really find disturbing is this letter that three Republicans led by Jim Jordan sent to the Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg, demanding that he turn over documents and testify about, quote, a politically motivated prosecutorial decision. Now, I've been highly critical of Bragg's weak and somewhat unimportant case. But you can't ask a prosecutor to testify in the midst of an ongoing criminal investigation. And I'm sure Bragg is going to resist. Because then each side, depending on who's in power, will attempt to do that in other high-profile indictment cases. You can't demand that a prosecutor, even if the prosecutor seems to you to be completely politically motivated, to come and testify because somebody who you like got charged. I mean, Donald Trump used to complain publicly about people who he didn't like who should be arrested and so forth, but he didn't actually do anything. You could say he was trying to pressure Bill Barr to do certain things. But, you know, what this would lead to is, you know, back and forth, each side trying to not only discredit the prosecutors they don't like, but basically stop them, harass them, demand that they come testify. It would totally blow up the law enforcement system. You know what else makes this look political? Bragg passed on this case a year ago, prompting two of his prosecutors to quit. His predecessor as DA, Cy Vance, passed on the case. So did the feds. So why resurrect it now? So as we dive into story number one, here's the New York Times kind of doing a little bit of an examination of the case. You may know some of this because we've talked about it. Bringing an untested case against anyone, let alone a former president, carries the risk that a court could throw out or narrow the case. It begins by saying that interviews with election law experts strongly suggest that New York State prosecutors have never before filed an election law case involving a federal campaign. So what does that tell you? Is this a prosecution that's being brought only to get Donald Trump? Never happened before. That is fascinating. We also have a situation where Trump's reimbursement of Michael Cohen, who's going to be the star witness for all his credibility problems. And by the way, his lawyer, Lanny Davis, yesterday told him to stop doing TV interviews. He's basically, you know, been on the tube around the clock after he got into a pretty fiery clash with the last witness to testify, Robert Costello, who says that he dealt with Cohen at the time and tells a very different story, one much more favorable to Trump. In New York, falsifying business records can be a crime. The false business records charge is the bread and butter of the DA's office. Since Bragg took office last year, prosecutors have filed 117 felony counts of the charge against 29 individuals and companies. Meanwhile, Joe Tacopina, Trump's lawyer, went on GMA and said, "We are distorting laws to try and bag President Trump. He had to pay money because there was going to be an allegation that was going to be publicly embarrassing to him, regardless of the campaign," meaning he didn't want Melania to know. Okay, probably the most interesting story of the day here. Donald Trump claims he is ready for his perp walk. The Times reporting that behind closed doors, the former president has told friends and associates he welcomes the idea of being paraded by the authorities before a throng of reporters and news cameras. He's even mused openly about whether he would smile for the assembled media, and he has pondered how the public would react and is said to have described the potential spectacle as a fun experience. No one is quite sure that his remarks are bravado or genuine resignation about what lies ahead. If he is truly looking forward to it, he might be disappointed. There's no indication that New York City authorities plan to walk him past a cluster of journalists. If he is indicted and surrenders, arrangements are likely to be made between the Secret Service and the NYPD to avoid a media circus. So you would think he would want to avoid a media circus, you know, go in through the back door and all that. But somehow Trump has this impression that this will rally his base even more. Another person who's spoken with Trump said he was less concerned with the particulars of where he would be seen than with being assured of the opportunity to show the public he is not slinking away in shame, as most people would do. Trump has often appeared disconnected from the severity of his potential legal woes, according to people who spent time with him. He's been spotted zipping around his Palm Beach resort in his golf course and acted as a DJ at a party recently with his personally curated Spotify playlist, ranging from the Rolling Stones to Phantom of the Opera. When Trump has focused on the case, one of four criminal investigations, he has concentrated on projecting strength, avoiding any signals of shame over his circumstances, an approach that mirrors his handling of repeated political crises, and his flair for creating dramatic made-for-TV moments. Said one person he wants to be defiant, to show the world that if they can do this to him, they can do it to anyone. There's even a suggestion in this piece that Trump is engaging in magical thinking, that somehow the personal attacks he's unleashed against investigators might persuade Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan DA, to walk away from the case. That seems highly unlikely. But Trump has a history of believing he can bend external events to his will. Well, he's certainly bending the coverage to his will. He's certainly portraying himself as a victim. And he is prepared, if he wins a second term, to be the retribution for all of his supporters. Here's the Washington Post writer, but like, how do you campaign if you're under indictment? And remember, you know, there might be a case in Georgia as well. The escalating criminal jeopardy confronting Trump has restored him to his political comfort zone. Former president isn't waiting for an official indictment or arrest to deploy an aggressive political response, already criticizing Bragg and Michael Cohen as Trump aides plot further attacks. And they're capitalizing on the coverage in conservative media outlets, raising over $1.5 million since Saturday. So this has been a kind of a golden spigot for him. Campaign is working to turn the case into pressure on Trump's primary rivals, forcing them to take questions about Trump. So this is classic, you know. I've said from the day he got into this race, Trump believes that all publicity is good, even if it's bad publicity. And this is a classic example. I mean, you know, any other politician you can think of would be finished if indicted, and not to mention all the allegations against such a politician. Donald Trump has actually gone up in the polls in recent weeks. He's got most of the Republican Party behind him. And, of course, he thrives on this sort of crisis where he can go on the attack and counterpunch and all that. But advisors privately acknowledge many potential pitfalls, as the Post. The campaign has not worked out the logistics of simultaneously mounting a presidential run and facing a criminal trial, possibly more than one. And Trump is back to, you know, saying this is a witch hunt. And that's the flavor of it. So, this is something. A YouGov poll. Did Trump commit a crime? 65% said definitely or probably. that includes 89% of Democrats, 66% of independents, and even 41% of Republicans. But then you get to question two. Do you think Donald Trump will ever be indicted for any alleged crime? Only 46% said definitely or probably, similar partisan breakdown. I mean, since Trump himself has said, I'm going to be arrested, you'd think those numbers would be higher. They're not saying, do you believe he should be prosecuted? You say this, the question the pollsters were asking is, will he? Stormy Daniels saying, I won't walk, I'll dance down the street when he is selected to go to jail, she said on Twitter. Wow, it's a beautiful morning, she said. Anything exciting going on today? Well, I think she thought maybe yesterday would be the day. Now, here's a tracking poll from Morning Consult showing Trump more than doubling DeSantis, 54% to just 26% for DeSantis. Lowest level for the Florida governor since this particular poll began in December. Hypothetical head-to-head matchup, Biden winning against Trump by 3 points, winning by 2 points against DeSantis. I mean, those are essentially tied. So that's kind of amazing. You've got to admit, I understand concerns about Joe's age and all of that, but you got the incumbent president of the United States who has not been tainted by scandal. I mean, there is the investigation, of course, into his mishandling of classified documents against a guy who says he's about to be arrested, not to mention all the other baggage that Trump brings in the wake of January 6th, etc. And of course, this is a ridiculously early poll, but he's essentially tied. Biden's essentially tied with both Trump and DeSantis. Now, let's move on to this Piers Morgan interview with Ron DeSantis. Because on my show on Sunday, I said this is a mistake. DeSantis is being defined by Donald Trump. He's not pushing back. He's not punching back. And my two guests, Kevin Cork and Ben Domenech, both said I was wrong. I mean, they did make the valid point that it's very early. Most people aren't tuned in. Why should the governor, who's not going to announce for a few months, get into a mud fight now? But this is the reason. But with Piers Morgan, he seems to have taken the gloves off to some extent. I also think my approach to leadership, I get personnel in the government who have the agenda of the people and share our agenda. You bring your own agenda in, you're gone. We're just not going to have that. There will be no daily drama. I don't know, this is about the nicknames, how to spell the sanctimonious one. I don't really know what it means, but I kind of like it. It's long, it's got a lot of vowels. We'll go with that, that's fine. I mean, you can call me whatever you want, just as long as you call me a winner, because that's what we've been able to do in Florida, is put a lot of points on the board and really take this state to the next level. Everything else is just background noise, says DeSantis. So on CNN, Van Jones, notable commentator and former Obama administration official, also said that Alvin Bragg should hold back on indicting Trump. He says, though, until the former president is charged with more serious wrongdoings. So he says if anybody's a Republican and they had been afraid that there's some well-organized conspiracy among progressives, they can relax now because you would not start with this charge. You would start with the charge in Georgia where he was interfering with elections. You would start with the charge that he was helping the insurrectionists in a coup. You wouldn't start with an 8-year-old porn star payoff. So even liberals like Van Jones are saying, he's just saying this case shouldn't go first or shouldn't be brought at all. I would not be surprised if he doesn't step back from the brink. It doesn't seem the right way to go.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Okay, story number two. A scoop by ABC News about Special Counsel Jack Smith, who is leading the DOJ investigation. Now, I don't know how ABC got this, but according to a sealed filing written by a judge, a federal judge, That finding concluded that the special counsel presented compelling preliminary evidence that shows that Trump, quote, knowingly and deliberately misled his own attorneys regarding his unlawful retention of classified documents. It's a preliminary finding, but it enables certain things to go forward. So as a result of that, this judge said that attorney-client privileges can be overridden and ordered that Evan Corcoran, an attorney for Trump who worked on the documents business, must comply with a grand jury subpoena for testimony on six separate lines of inquiry. Now, I suppose that can be contested, but it is a significant look into what's going on in the DOJ probe. Prosecutors have repeatedly asked Corcoran and Trump lawyer Christina Bob, who signed the certified letter, about their role in drafting and delivering the letter. Trump's response, of course he has one, shame on fake news ABC for broadcasting illegally leaked false allegations, I should say, from a never Trump, now former chief judge who just stepped down, against the Trump legal team. This disinformation is on a par with their breathless Russia, 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 Ukraine, 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 and no collusion Mueller speculation, all of which were totally disproven. These leaks are happening because there is no factual or legal basis or substance to any case against President Trump. This is issued on his behalf. Talking about the deranged Democrats and their comrades in the mainstream media. Story three. This is a remarkable bit of reporting by NPR. It begins by saying that last October, Rolling Stone had a pretty good scoop. The FBI had raided the home of a renowned journalist months earlier, and he had disappeared from public view. Instead, there was acrimony inside the newsroom about how that scoop was edited, leading to accusations that the editor of the magazine pulled punches in overseeing coverage of someone he knew, someone he was friendly with. The reporter who wrote the story was so enraged that she accepted a position at a sister publication 2 months later. The reporter is Tatiana Siegel, and she said that this April 22nd raid was quite possibly the first carried out by the Biden administration against a journalist, and there's a high bar for that. So the journalist in question is ABC News national security producer James Gordon Meek. He's a former investigator for the U.S. House Homeland Security Committee, been with ABC for 10 years. The story started by lionizing his record. Sources were quoted as saying that federal agents allegedly found classified information on Meek's laptop during the raid, and that Meek left his job at ABC after the raid. A publishing contract with Simon & Schuster evaporated. But now we get to the part about Rolling Stone editor Noah Schachtman. He warned her against turning in a story that included the words child pornography. According to two people with knowledge, Mark Zaid, a Washington attorney, called Schachtman on Meek's behalf. Zaid confirms that he called Schachtman and tells NPR that Meek was a longtime friend and client. According to what Siegel, the reporter, told others, Schachtman and she agreed the article would reflect the FBI's interest stem from concerns of possible criminal behavior outside the scope of Meek's work. That is, had nothing to do with national security. So, Rolling Stone's parent company, Penske Media, notes that the authority to make these editorial decisions at Rolling Stone lies with Schachtman. You know, he's the editor, he can do what he wants. But she unfortunately... this is interesting. There's a note on Slack in which Schachtman said, let's not use a picture of the guy in question, James Gordon Meek. Let's do something that, you know, is like something FBI-y, please. So if you have a whole story about a raid on this guy's house and you don't run a picture of him, what's up with that? Anyway, Siegel was pulled away to help care for her ailing mother. Schachtman promised he would make sure that the story was properly edited. And unfortunately, Siegel's mother died hours after the story was posted. So, Schachtman changed Siegel's draft to remove all suggestions that this was not related to Meek's reporting. On February 1st, the Justice Department unveiled criminal charges against Meek related to images of child sex abuse. What comes next is just too awful to read, but it's a description of a video involving a very young child. Meek pleaded not guilty, is currently in federal custody. So Siegel was right. Tatiana Siegel was right that his house was raided by the FBI and the child porn was involved, and that was all taken out of the story. And so she left to go to Variety, and the parent company is defending the editing. But it looks like something was held back that the reporter did, in fact, have nailed down. Story number four, and this is a deep dive. Pretty powerful column by Jerry Baker in the Wall Street Journal, former editor of the newspaper. And we are just now marking the 23rd anniversary of the Iraq War. And so a lot of people are revisiting that, and debating it, relitigating it, of course. Here's what Baker has to say. Some of those who supported the invasion of Iraq 20 years ago this week are making the best defense they can of what the rest of us long ago concluded was probably the most flawed decision in American foreign policy since the founding of the Republic. Okay, so we start by not pulling any punches. To defend the war on the grounds that Iraq is no threat is premised on an obvious fallacy that invasion was necessary to ensure this outcome, meaning no threat today. We know this wasn't true. Saddam Hussein had been in his United Nations inspections cage for more than a decade already by 2003, which of course was the year of the invasion. After the 9/11 attacks, the scrutiny and containment was only getting tighter. Do we really think, given what he was witnessing in Afghanistan, that he would be insane enough to attack the U.S. or its allies? I think the answer there is undoubtedly no. We know for sure that the argument that the inspections regime was dangerously insufficient didn't hold up. Because to bolster it, advocates of war had to adduce lurid claims about weapons of mass destruction. Anybody who was alive at that time knows how often we heard those claims from the Bush administration. WMD, weapons of mass destruction, which, of course, was never found. Robert Draper, in a book at the time, methodically documents the campaign of deception, including self-deception. Remember, this is a slam dunk, the head of the CIA at the time told President Bush, that officials deployed, pointing frantically at every molehill of intelligence that supported the case and dismissing the mountains that cast doubt on it. It is astonishingly blithe to say that hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who died in the internecine strife that took place under the supervision of the U.S., that they might have died in any case. What kind of vacuum of conscience does it take to balance a known historical tragedy against a hypothetical one and conclude that they have equal moral weight? Jerry Baker writes in that true British style in which, you know, there's a very sharp quill pen that is really taken to the other side. It's not just like, you know, mistakes were made. He goes on to say, the promulgation of the WMD fictions, the Abu Ghraib horrors, this was the use of all kinds of what most people would call torture techniques, in the prison there that U.S. authorities had set up for Iraqi detainees, the catastrophically inept initial occupation and administration, all undid in a matter of months the post-Cold War authority and heft the U.S. had earned over decades. Almost every calamity that followed, Iran's ascent, the rise of ISIS, Barack Obama's disastrous failure in Syria, can be traced more or less directly to the war. In other words, this would just be a different place, and America would be a different place, had it not been for George W. Bush's decision to do what his father had not done during the Gulf War, which is go into Baghdad. And, of course, Saddam Hussein was ultimately killed. Just to wrap this dive up, much worse, and this is troubling, is the damage the war did to the fabric of American democracy. The American people were terrified by their government into war, with the bogus menace of nuclear weapons wielded by a man with bogus connections to the 9/11 terrorists. They were promised a war that would be a cakewalk, it was actually a word that was used, followed by an occupation in which their sons and daughters would be greeted with sweets and flowers. We would be greeted as liberators. I think it was Dick Cheney or another high official in the Bush administration who said that. This cloud castle of fictions did incalculable damage to the bonds of trust between Americans and their leaders. That reminds me in an earlier generation of Vietnam, when it turned out our country was not told the truth by leaders in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. Worse still is that there's been no accountability, this is probably the key paragraph from my point of view, for the architects of the debacle. The political leaders have mostly moved on, but with Olympic-level chutzpah, many of the so-called intellectuals who advocated it are still out there lecturing the American people that it's treasonous to oppose immersing America into other conflicts. Is there a word for the complete lack of self-awareness you need to possess to denounce Donald Trump and the new conservative populism, even as you are principally responsible for the disasters that ignited it? Because he has this theory that what happened in Iraq inexorably led to the populism that enabled Donald Trump to be elected. Those who supported that terrible misadventure should admit our shameful error, or failing that, take an oath of respectful silence. When he says our shameful error, I think Jerry Baker is saying that he also, you know, was persuaded to support the Iraq invasion, and that now there's just no way, looking back 20 years ago. Obviously, people have other views on this, but that's a powerful column, and I wanted to share it with you. And it caused me to reflect on that time when the Homeland Security Department was created and so much went on that changed both our politics, both here at home and abroad.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
All right, number five. Google has been watching for months as projects of AI, Microsoft principally, have stoked the public's imagination. But yesterday, says the New York Times, Google tentatively stepped off the sidelines as it released a chatbot called Bard. Well, I will acknowledge that it's a better name than GPT. And by the way, I got an email from Google. I wasn't singled out personally, but because I'm a Google One customer, I got asked if I want to participate in testing it. So I figured, well, this would be good fodder. So I clicked yes, and now I'm on a waiting list to see how Bard performs. Now, the company's being kind of cautious about this because it's trying to show that Google is capable of providing similar tech, but its competitors have faced criticism that they're proliferating an unpredictable and sometimes untrustworthy technology. Many in the tech industry believe that Google has a lot to lose and to gain from AI. But so rather than doing it in chatbot form, it's doing it as a web page, because that's how Google makes its money, selling advertising when you click on its web page. So when you do a search now, or at least this thing is obviously still in beta, a chatbot can instantly produce answers and complete sentences that don't force you to scroll through a list of results as you would with a search engine. Now, Google's vice president quoted as saying, "We're well aware of the issues. We need to bring this to market responsibly." At the same time, we see all the excitement in the industry, excitement of people using AI. So Google doesn't want to be left behind and be this dinosaur where everybody else is using these artificial intelligence chatbots. And, you know, one of the things that Google has done to itself is you now have to scroll through the first five or six results that are all sponsored. That people pay money to get to the top of the Google list before you find what you're actually looking for, unless you want to go to people who are paying Google to put their results at the top. So Google plans to introduce the following AI features called Shopping Try-On. It's interesting. And the ability to create background images for YouTube videos and Pixel phones. So Google desperately wants into this game, at the same time as trying not to overhype it. It knows that the chatbot these chatbots, which, as I noted 1 or 2 days ago, have the memory of a goldfish. Every new search begins anew and can only deal with sort of like 4,000 words at a time. But you wouldn't expect a giant tech company like Google to just sit on the sidelines. So it's trying to get in the game cautiously, tiptoe in. And if I do get a shot at testing this thing, since they were nice enough to invite me, I will share the results with you. I'll tell Google, too. I think that's what they want. They want feedback to figure out what's working and what's not. And I am more than happy to sound off on that. With that, this is the real me, not a chatbot. Thank you for listening, sharing this time with me as we try to get as much interesting stuff in as we can, even as Trump dominates the political landscape in terms of news. And I will see you all tomorrow with more BuzzMeter.
Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts and via Apple Podcasts, and Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.